Who run the world?
We
girls.
Do.
Thank you.
Oh. Okay.
Ashley's totally listened to Beyonce before.
Hello and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast. It sounds so weird without new. A podcast
just from the podcast.
From the underwhelmingly young, modestly hip, and unassumingly lay editors of America Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Olga Segura.
Hey, guys.
And Zach Davis.
Happiest of Wednesday to you, and happiest of Fridays to our listeners. Or whatever day you happen to be consuming this podcast.
Okay.
How you guys doing?
Great.
Pretty good. Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah, pretty high-spirited Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a busy time in America. We just released this new study on women in the church, and it's a big deal.
It's a pretty very big deal.
It's the first ever comprehensive survey of U.S. Catholic women. You would think that this like very important part of the church, you know, the church would want to know what they are thinking. But before, we just kind of spoke in generalizations, like Catholic women think this, but we didn't really know what Catholic women think. Mm-hmm. And now we do.
And they've been asked in like survey, like women have been pulled out of
more general surveys,
mm-hmm. but there's never been a whole comprehensive one on women.
Yeah, yeah. So we cover things from like how often they go to Mass to their political leanings and everything in between.
And we should say that like it was not editors at America that just like were calling people unscientifically and asking random, like, are you a Catholic woman? What do you think about this?
You mean our Jesuitical polls aren't scientifically valid?
The margin of error is too high, I think, to pass high school statistics class. But we worked with a professional firm, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We worked with Georgetown University's Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate. It's a very well-respected survey group. And so it was an online survey, went out to a representative sample. So it passes all the bars for what you want when you're looking for statistically significant results.
Yes.
So who are we going to be talking to?
Yeah. So this study actually just came out in our January 22nd issue, which is our Women in the Life of the Church. So we're going to be talking to Carrie Weber, who kind of spearheaded this entire issue and was very much involved in the survey. And she wrote a feature article in this issue. So we're going to be talking to her about some of the most surprising findings in the survey and about what it means to be a role model for Catholic women and what it means to be a Catholic woman in the church in 2018. So
yes. And we should mention that she is an executive editor here
at
America.
Yes, she is an executive editor, and I'm going to say a role model for me, like very much
a boss lady for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely much what I envision Catholic female journalists to be.
Yeah.
So Carrie has come all the way down the hall to join us live in studio.
Yeah. Very exciting.
And I'm really excited about this week's drink. It is an elderflower thistle.
Why do you have to say it like that, Zach?
Sounds like it is from Lord of the Rings. But it's not. It's from St. Germain and Jameson. So funny story about this. So this recipe actually calls for St. Germain and scotch. And Ashley was sent out to...
I had one job.
Ashley was sent out to get the scotch. And she came back with a bottle of Irish whiskey.
Oh, Ashley.
And Ashley's like, that's not scotch? And I said, no, believe it or not, scotch is not like a misnomer or a trick question. It's just...
You know, I thought it was like scotch tape.
So guys, because
I'm from Scotland is what you're telling me.
Yes.
Not Ireland.
Your mistake has led to a great new...
Yeah, this is delicious.
It's delicious.
Can you guys describe it to me? Because I'm still not drinking, so I need to live through you guys, through your descriptions right now.
It's like if you added a bunch of flowery sugar to some Jameson.
Yeah, or if you were like me and you ate those little purple flowers that grew in like your lawn, tastes like that.
Okay, you guys both gave me... Very
normal thing to say, Ashley. Thank you.
Okay, so
all right, cheers. All right, but now it's time for Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to. First, because this is dropping on Friday, we just want to give a quick shout out to all those who are at the 45th annual March for Life. There are thousands of young people gathered in Washington to mark the anniversary of Roe versus Wade and protest the existence of legal abortion in this country.
And they do it in the bitter cold.
They do.
So I hope you brought hand warmers, marchers.
Yeah. But next, Pope Francis is on one of his great foreign trips where he always makes news both either on the way there, on the way back. He gives his papal press conferences. And this year, on Monday, he was asked about his thoughts on nuclear war. And he said rather bluntly, "I am truly afraid of nuclear war. All it would take is an accident." So I don't know. I think of Pope Francis is kind of unflappable.
Mm-hmm.
I know, generally hopeful about the world.
So and to kind of hear him say, like, "Yeah, I'm terrified of this," it's like, okay, this just makes me even more afraid.
I'm kind of like, you're not supposed to tell us that.
Yeah, Pope Francis, I look to you for like strength.
If something bad's about to happen, your parents aren't supposed to tell you about it. Like, you put on a brave face and just, you know, carry on.
Yeah, so, but he's doing this, you know, he has talked about nuclear weapons a lot, and the reason he's, you know, expressing his fear is in the hope that it will lead to nuclear disarmament. He has called the mere possession of nuclear arms immoral, so he's breaking with past popes who were okay with the idea of deterrence, and he's saying, no, we need to get rid of them because an accident could lead to millions of people dying.
Mm-hmm.
And his response to this question came in the context of Hawaii, where...
Yeah, speaking of accidents and...
such an nukes. Accident, you know, could have led to something really terrible.
Right, right. Yeah, this past Saturday, an emergency management employee actually set off fear all across Hawaii, and Hawaii residents suffered for 38 minutes. They thought that there was going to be a missile headed their way. And it took a whole 38 minutes for the error to be fixed.
It was sent out as a push notification.
Yeah, it was sent out as a push notification, and the exact notification said, "Ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill." So for 38 minutes, Hawaii residents thought that their lives were essentially going to end. And we've got Christopher Milano, a pastoral administrator at the Newman Center in Honolulu. He wrote a reflection for us about what those 38 minutes were like for him. And what I found really interesting about this was I got the New York Times alert and I was kind of like, oh, the error has been fixed. Let's move on.
I was not like that. I was like,
because I'm in my New York bubble and I'm so far removed from the reality
they're
of this.
They're coming here next. Yeah. If it's
but
Hawaii.
You see, like this is like Pope Francis is saying, this is very much a reality and a fear for Hawaii residents. So Christopher Milano, he was on a confirmation retreat with his students and he was just mentioning how these kids were so terrified and calling their parents. And I just want to read what he said. "There we stood around, took a few deep breaths, centered ourselves, and surrendered everything to God. We prayed, we embraced, and we waited together."
Wow.
Yeah.
That's awful. That would just be horrifying.
Yeah.
I
can't imagine what that would... And these are kids, not even adults.
And being being the adult that feels responsible for all these kids.
Because he mentions in the
moment,
piece, he's like, we can't... They were turning to us for answers that we just could not provide. Yeah. We couldn't tell them, like, this... Don't worry about this. This is not something to be concerned with, you know?
But there's, like, a great spiritual lesson out of this, I guess. like, whoever... you might have been thinking about in that moment, the things you want to say, the things you want to do. I mean,
the things you might regret.
Yeah. Right. Jesus says you know not the hour, right? And so you have to... We should, as Christians, be living like that all the time. Mm-hmm. But...
Yeah. Which is not to say I want to get a false notification that New York is about to...
Yeah, the best way to, you know, make people act like it's not a drill is to tell them it's not, I suppose.
All right, what's next, Zach?
So our next story comes from this new survey that America put out in conjunction with the CARA. And we figured we'd bring this stat up because I don't think we're going to talk about it as much in the interview. Mm-hmm. But it said that Catholic women might actually be part of the Democratic wave that is coming in 2018, that people are predicting is coming.
Mm-hmm.
Overall in the survey... it found that 59% of Catholic women are Democrats or lean Democratic, whereas 38% are Republican or lean Republican.
Yeah, no, there are some really interesting stats about the political leanings of Catholic women. So, like, as you would imagine, Republicans care more about abortion as an issue, and Democrats care more about the environment. But there was this broad base of support for, like, what we would consider the consistent ethic of life kind of issues. So most Republican Catholic women care about the environment, and a significant, I think it's like 40% of Catholic Democratic women say that church teaching on abortion influences how they think about voting. So, I mean, yes, we're in like a very polarized time, and we can talk about like the Democratic wave coming against Trump, but it does seem like this data points to this like large portion of Catholic women who don't fit very comfortably in either camp, which I think it's something we've talked about before about mm-hmm. feeling kind of politically homeless.
Yeah, yeah. We talked about that with Kirsten in our Kirsten Powers interview, the sort of, like you were saying, Ashley, women, Catholic women don't really feel like they're too Republican or they're too Democrat. And I think it also ties into what Pope Francis has told us. Like, we're supposed to think about not party affiliation, but what it means to be Christian and what it means to, like, bring Catholic social teaching into our politics, you know?
Mm-hmm. And there is a racial dimension here, too, that sort of doesn't get brought out in the survey yeah. because Hispanic Catholics are more likely to lean mm-hmm. Democratic mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. white Catholics are more yeah. likely to lean Republican.
Yeah. And I think one interesting fact that this piece also pointed out, too, was that the midterm elections are kind of going to reflect what we've seen in a lot of recent statewide elections, where we've seen a large portion of women, especially Black women, that are sort of setting this trend. And it seems like Catholic women are going to follow in that same, like, in that same path, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we have seen that mm-hmm. women are decisive in elections.
Yeah.
And so I think that's one reason that America decided to do this survey mm-hmm. is because, you know, if we are so decisive, Olga, maybe people would want to know what we actually think.
So what's next, Ashley?
So I watched a football game on Sunday.
Wow.
And I got really into it. It was the Vikings versus the Saints. And the Vikings, against all odds, pulled off a win in the last seconds. They were down. They had a 17-0 lead in the third quarter, lost it. We're down in the fourth quarter, seconds to go. Threw a 61-foot pass and caught it, and it was great. So I was hoping I could, you know, talk about this and find a Catholic angle. And I did.
Yes,
Zach's,
you did.
Zach's favorite.
So it turns out we've all heard the expression, the Hail Mary pass. Mm-hmm. And that came from a crushing loss that the Vikings suffered in 1975. Yeah.
Wow.
So they were in the playoffs, lost to the
Dallas Cowboys
when their quarterback, a Catholic, something Staubach.
Roger Staubach.
All right. So
Roger,
all right, fine. You just go.
I'm really giving you your space.
Go, Zach.
So 1975, the NFC divisional playoff game. Roger Staubach threw a 50-yard bomb to Drew Pearson. Its time was expiring. There's like 30 seconds left. Mm-hmm. So actually, this Sunday's pass was
even
more dramatic.
Miraculous. Yeah.
But that is where the phrase Hail Mary comes from, because Roger claims he just said one right before.
Mm-hmm. The best part of this article, though,
yeah, so, Roger is hoping that he's no longer going to be hated in Minnesota, because now it's been this play has maybe eased
redemption.
The wounds. But he said, are there any prayers left? When they asked, like, what could they call this play? They could call Diggs's catch the Apostles' Creed or something, which is like,
oh my God,
easily the worst name for a play I've ever heard. But I did some reporting last night, actually. So I was in Baltimore and I found some Minnesotans who were at the game.
Oh, okay. Oh,
wow. Ellen Connick, who is a fan of the show, was on the 50-yard line this pass. And so I asked her what would she name this miraculous play. Mm-hmm. And out of respect for alliteration, she opted Diggs, the guy who caught the ball, mm-hmm. Diggs's Divine Mercy, because nice. It ended the suffering of the Minnesota Vikings fans.
I like that.
Great.
All right, what's next, Olga?
So Bishop Philip Egan of Portsmouth, England, recently made headlines. He stated that Catholic churches should stay open all day. He was visiting parishes and was surprised to find that doors were locked. So now he's kind of saying that it's hypocritical, churches should be open all the time, which I think is fascinating. I have never really ventured into seeing what church hours are, but I looked into like the parish I grew up with and was surprised to find that they're closed like 2-3 days a week. And I'm just thinking, shouldn't they be open? What do you guys think?
Yeah, no, I've had the experience of stopping by a church, wanting to just go in and pray and being like, why is this locked? Mm-hmm. It's like 5 o'clock in the
right,
afternoon.
Right.
Like,
no, I go pretty hard on the leave them open all the time. End of the camp. I think
and
the
so
adults.
This bishop,
and, yeah.
He contrasted it with the Church of England, which apparently they do advise their bishops to have a policy mm-hmm. of open doors. And he thought that the Catholic Church should adopt a similar policy.
I think there are going to be adults in the room, in a lot of rooms, who are going to talk about all the practical reasons why we couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And I think they're wrong. You know, the church asks us to be fools for Christ, to do things that seem silly and impractical. And this is like, it's a fundamental thing, right? Like, I think of after 9/11, a lot of pastors talked about how they immediately went and opened the church doors because that was such a traumatic event in the lives of everyone. But people go through trauma all the, like, you never know when that's going to happen. And if someone wants to turn to the church, wants to talk to God, and they get there and the door's locked, like, that makes such an impression that lasts.
So are you saying churches should be open 24/7, 365 days a year?
Absolutely.
Huh. What do you think, Ashley?
I mean, I think I'd probably stake out the middle ground. I know you're shocked, moderate that I am. But, you know.
The adult in the room you are.
You know, I think hours that you are generally, would it, you know, an average person would expect to be able to go to a church and find it open. So, you know, maybe like 6 to 10 or something. Mm-hmm. Because I think like some things we need to take into consideration is that, you know, there are, you know, just like practically speaking, like women who are probably going to be women or men, but probably women cleaning these churches after hours. Mm-hmm. And do they feel safe doing that if the door is open and they're, you know, in an unsafe neighborhood, or maybe your, you know, insurance premiums will go up? And are those resources better used in your social ministries that are directly serving people experiencing homelessness? So there is like a balance that I think you can strike of being a place of welcome for people, but taking into consideration the broken world we live in, and that, you know, you're risking people getting hurt, property getting hurt, money being lost that could be used in a better way.
Yeah, but I really think Jesus asks us to take those risks. I think of, I don't know if this is cheesy, but the scene from Les Mis where Jean Valjean gets, you know, led into this this guy's home, and Jean steals from this dude after he feeds him and gives him a place to stay, gets caught, gets brought back to this dude, and the police are like, this man stole from you. And he goes, oh, no, he's an honored guest, and he forgot this too. Mm-hmm. I think that's the type of thing we're called to do. And like, just,
I think this was all a ploy for you to get to sing Les Mis.
I won't. I will keep people. There's so many. 2, 4, 6, 0, 1.
There we go. There we go.
I had a very serious point to make, and I was baited into singing.
Yeah, so it's not your fault.
The Church of England recommends that churches keep their doors open because churches are actually more likely to be attacked when they're locked because, you know, if criminals probably feel like if someone's going to walk in, they're not going to do it. But if it's locked and it's closed, no one's expecting a criminal to show up. But theologically, we require that a sanctuary lamp be lit all the time anywhere there's a tabernacle. And I don't know what the point is of having a sanctuary lamp lit all the time if people can't sit in the presence of God at any time.
Because Jesus needs a night lamp.
That, but also, I don't know, you said like not church hours you would expect, so like at, like before 10 p.m., but like nothing good happens after midnight, and who do you need when nothing good is happening?
Lots of good things happen.
Jesus. That's true. All right, but maybe listeners, you're in charge of a church. Maybe you're the one that locks the doors and you have strong feelings about this, I'm imagining. Or maybe you've gone to a church and it's been locked. What do you think about this? Write us at jesuitical@americanmedia.org.
She turns her head to face the sun, but sees the moon still shining. My angel, where have you gone to? And sunshine, why'd you go away?
And now we are excited to welcome one of America's executive editors, Carrie Weber. Welcome to Jesuitical, Carrie.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
We're very excited too. So you were kind of integral to this new study that America Media put out this week. Can you tell us its origin story?
Sure. So in 2013, we did an issue that was edited and written by women. And
I have a question about that, actually. So did that mean, I'm going to interrupt you.
Uh-huh. That's right. Fresh out the gate.
Okay.
Here comes
Zach. Great for women's voices. Go on, Zach.
So did that mean, like, I wasn't here at America at that time. So did that mean, like, the male editors were just not working that week?
Yo, everyone else got the week off. No.
That's what I, no, okay, no. All right.
It was just me and Carrie and Olga.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Just the three
there's
of us.
Actually a lot of us. I mean, I think, you know, other people contributed, like, in the copy and in the proofreading, the general magazine
got it.
Roles. Oh, okay. Most of the, all the writing and most of, like, the first edits, the big substantial edits, were done by the female staff writers.
Got it. Okay. Sorry, please continue.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So in that issue, we made a promise to continue the commitment to women's voices in the church, right? That it's not like, oh, every 5 years, we're going to let ladies talk. So we did that. And as part of that, I was writing an editorial one day about women in the church. And I started to write like, oh, Catholic women think X. And I realized, I was like, I think that's just what I think Catholic women think, and not, I don't know if there's anything actually statistically speaking that will back this up. So I called Mark Gray, who is one of the researchers over at CARA, the Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate at Georgetown University, who does this sort of thing for a living, and said, do these stats exist? And he said, no. And then I went to Father Matt Malone, our editor-in-chief, and I said, can we make them exist? And he said, yeah, absolutely. And then here we are.
There we go.
So what findings have surprised you the most, Carrie?
I mean, I think one of the things that just really struck me overall was the contrast between the number of women who are sort of engaged on a, you know, regular basis in their parish, which turns out to be relatively low, even, you know, with only 24% of women went to Mass weekly or more, you know, which is a very low number for something that's supposed to be where we receive the Eucharist and the source and summit of our faith, etc. But 82% of Catholic women had never considered even leaving the church, which I find just a fascinating contrast, because it means there's something that is keeping women connected to the faith, whether that's history or tradition or family or rituals or a sense of personal spirituality. That means when some random polling company calls you up, you will still, well, actually, it was an internet-based poll, just because they are more honest that way, actually.
Yeah,
you know, when you do have to answer these questions for a stranger, you're going to say, yeah, I'm Catholic, and that's how I identify. Even if in the day-to-day basis, you're not necessarily participating in the way that the church sort of hopes you might. But it doesn't mean that you're not Catholic, and it doesn't mean that you can't eventually participate more, or that there aren't other ways you might be engaging with your faith that are meaningful and that are contributing to a faith community.
What would you say to those who might look at this study and say, you know, if you're not going to Mass, you know, regularly and going to confession and having a Catholic wedding, then you're not a real Catholic.
Which sadly is not a hypothetical.
Yeah.
I'm looking on social media lately.
Yeah.
I think anytime we get into categorizing people as real Catholics or not real Catholics, we get into a very dangerous zone of trying to be the final judge of someone's soul, and that's not our job at all. And I think that our role is to try to be a community and be that body of Christ to each other, and to encourage each other to become more integrally connected to that community. But to understand that at times people have been caused real pain by this community, by our community of faith, that people have reason that they might not feel as connected to the church or to God now as they might in the future or they might have in the past. And to meet people where they are and to walk with them in that path, and hopefully a path that sort of leads back to this community that can be more fruitful and more healing for them.
Yeah, it strikes me as so strange that people who consider themselves real Catholics, and so presumably like believe in baptism and the indelible like mark it leaves on someone's soul, would like, you know, then just discard that because
that thing you can't undo.
Here's the thing, like, you don't get to once you're baptized, you don't get to opt out, right? You're a Catholic. The church considers you Catholic because you have been baptized. You may not have received all the sacraments to fully integrate you into the church as an adult and fully initiate you through confirmation, etc., but you're Catholic and you're on that path, and you might be at a different point than somebody else, but you're still there and you're still welcome back and you're still a child of God and loved just as much as anybody else, Catholic or not.
Yeah, I dusted off my catechism when I was preparing to like respond to people.
Everyone's usual rituals before they go on Twitter.
But no, and I was looking at the baptism part of it, and it was like, there's a line, the whole ecclesial community bears some responsibility for the development and safeguarding of the grace given at baptism. So it's literally the church's job to say there's grace there, and it's there whether they are going to Mass every week or not. And the role of the church is to, you know, try to cooperate with that grace, not to call them fake Catholics.
Help people to recognize it and where it is active and in the world in really wonderful and beautiful ways.
So it's something you mentioned was that, you know, not going to Mass is not ideal, right? Because this is where we receive the Eucharist. Mm-hmm. But another finding in the study was that receiving the Eucharist, along with helping the poor, was one of the things that these women said defined their sense of Catholicism. Why do you think that is?
Hopefully it means that some element of our Catholic culture has stuck in, right? Mm-hmm. Like out of whatever, whether you've gone to Catholic school, or you've been raised in a Catholic family, or you knew a bunch of nuns at some point in your life, you've understood that at the core of our faith is the Eucharist and loving our neighbor as ourselves, right? And that's what those two things are. And that's what each of those things sort of feed into, right? If we come for the Eucharist, that we are then sent forth from Mass to go and serve others. And if we serve others, we're hopefully brought back into that community of the Eucharist, to the body of Christ in each other and at on the altar at Mass, that helps us to be better people, better Catholics, and better community.
Hmm. How do you think the parish community can like harness these findings, especially the finding that people really identify with helping the poor? Is that an opportunity to re-engage people so that they do come back to the sacraments?
Yeah, I mean,
often?
I think a lot of people are willing to engage in acts of service because they seem to be a little bit less intimidating than inviting somebody to like Eucharistic adoration or something. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say you shouldn't invite people to both, but if someone is been away from the church for a while, it's sometimes, for some people, right, easier to kind of come back in a way that seems like almost like a little bit more removed, even though it's just as integral, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, my parish in New Jersey is helping to sponsor a Colombian refugee family, and people are volunteering to take them to the grocery store, to help them with their budgeting, to donate clothes, all these sorts of things, give them rides to the doctor's office. And all these things are really integral to the faith and really integral to that sense of service and to that sense of community. And that ideally, you know, help to draw people together to help someone, but also draw people back into that community.
Yeah. So another thing, Carrie, that I found particularly interesting with the survey was that only 10% of women stated that they had experienced sexism within the church. Did you find that surprising, or do you think there's sort of a difference in the way that people can define sexism? I think especially in light of what we're seeing with the Me Too movement and all these scandals.
Yeah, I was surprised because anyone I mentioned this stat to was also surprised. Now, I think one interesting factor that you need to mention about this is that it is the question asked, have you ever personally experienced sexism in the church? Mm-hmm. And I think that personally is very relevant because there are some women who feel like, oh, you know, so-and-so said that, you know, pastor is sexist, but he's never done that to me. And
right.
So the question doesn't apply. Or they might feel that there's some sort of structural injustice, but that it doesn't affect them directly. So mm-hmm. it's not personally applying. And it could be that they just actually have not experienced sexism in the church,
right,
which is great. Like, ideally, it would be 0%,
mm-hmm.
right? So in some ways, 10% is a great number because it seems way less than the population at large. In another sense, 10% of women have been experiencing sexism by a group of believers who are trying to treat each other like they're, you know, they're children of God. That's not great.
Mm-hmm.
But what is interesting also is that, unfortunately, the numbers tend upward when you kind of take out subgroups of people who have gone to Catholic colleges, people who have gone to Catholic high schools, people who are more involved in parish ministry. The more involved people seem to be, mm-hmm. the more likely it is that they would have experienced sexism. So to some degree, if what your commitment is to the church is, or the parish or the institution is a weekly mass or less than that, there are actually very few opportunities to experience personally that mm-hmm. sexism in a sense. That's not a great selling point. We're not gonna be like, come into the church because for more opportunities for sexism. Right, right. Like, that's not the goal. It's not what the church is about.
So that's the personal side of it. Is there anything in the survey about, you mentioned the more like structural sexism. What did the survey find about how people perceive it more generally, the role of women in the church and in decision making?
Yeah, so 9 out of 10 women basically say the church, their local parish does a very much or somewhat does a good job of integrating women into the parish community, which is great because women are part of the parish community, right? So that, I mean, it's not like a major accomplishment there in a sense, but it is in that we're glad that people feel welcome, and that is part of our goal. When you ask women, you know, do you think the priest does a good job of integrating women into leadership roles or into decision-making in the parish, the number goes down. But on the other hand, the number is often higher among people who are actually very involved at the parish, because I think they probably see that more often than people who are less involved. So there might be an element of perception there. Like mm-hmm. people who don't go to mass as often or aren't as involved in a parish perceive that there are no women involved in the leadership or in the decision-making roles, whereas the women who are actually present, they might be the ones making those decisions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like anyone who spends a lot of time in the Catholic Church knows that like women are keeping it alive on a day-to-day basis. Like you wrote a feature article, which its title was "The Humble, Indispensable Women Leading the Catholic Church You've Probably Never Heard Of," right? So in some ways, this isn't surprising, right?
Well, one thing that was surprised me about the data is that a lot of those roles that we see filled by women is actually filled by a very small percentage of women. Hmm. So like when we asked, you know, have you participated as a catechist or as a usher, et cetera, et cetera, I think the highest proportion was 15% for catechism. People teaching catechism classes.
I can,
and
I
that
can
was it.
Anecdata, right? As someone who's on like the Eucharistic minister and lector list for my parish, like there aren't that many people.
It's all the same
you get
people.
Scheduled week after week. I mean, it is mostly women.
But. Yeah, and it's great. And I'm glad that they're visible. I'm glad that's important. But like as a percentage of the whole, you would want like more people involved in some of those.
And that's not, because that's not a sustainable model, right?
Having like 10 Catholic women run every parish everywhere? No, I don't think so. Although, I don't know, they're pretty feisty.
I put my money on those 10. Yeah, I was just going to say, I put my
that's
money.
That's not bad, but like, no, right? You need, who are they going to minister to if other people aren't, you know, involved?
Yeah.
So Carrie, one of the things that was also pretty interesting about your piece was how many women kind of shy away from the term role model. Why do you think that is?
And are you a role model?
I will answer. Yes, you are.
So, yeah, it was interesting when asked where people got their perceptions of Catholic, of what it meant to be like Catholic women from, that it was mostly their friends and family first. And then it was Catholic educators second. So that what it means is that people are getting their role models mostly from people that they know, which means that most of us are a role model to somebody, possibly without even knowing it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to remember, because if you are where someone is getting their model of the faith from, mm-hmm. that is a responsibility in a sense,
right,
to try to live out your faith in the most authentic way. But I think a lot of times we think of role models as this sort of perfect example of faith. And there is an element to that in like this, in the saints and in, you know, in Mary and all the people that we know of as the holy men and women of the church. But I think that it's very useful for us to try to remove that sense of perfection from this term role model, so that more people feel comfortable, willing to take it on and say, look, I am a role model. And that means I have a certain responsibility to people in the faith, to our community, to represent our community well, to represent this to each other well. When I went to Catholic grammar school in high school, we had uniforms, and they mm-hmm. always said, you know, wherever you are in that uniform, you are representing us.
Right, right.
Better not get in trouble at the park in that skirt. And like, And it kind of applies in a similar way. Like, we don't have a uniform
anymore. Can you change clothes?
Although I really wish. Yeah, you can change clothes and get in trouble. That's okay. Fine. Just don't implicate the school. And, you know, we put on our faith, right? We wear our faith in public in ways that have to be meaningful and useful and helps people who are trying to live a similar faith life to you to have a model to follow, perhaps, or maybe a model not to follow sometimes. like, this is how I screwed up. And then help people learn from that, and that's okay.
I really want to dig in on your mistakes.
Yeah.
If that's all right. I had a feeling like the whole setup about role models not being perfect was like a way in for you to...
Oh, I didn't answer that last question.
Yes,
the last. So when I did my article, you know, I spoke to these women who were they were very accomplished professionally. They were very, very strong foundation in their faith. They had been they had been academic deans and chancellors and spiritual advisors, all these things that to me clearly made them a role model. And so many of them were like, I think maybe you could call me that because of the reasons we sort of talked about. And I was like, oh, they should definitely call themselves role models. And this is why it's important to identify as a role model, like in my head. And yet I still have this. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I want to say that I'm a role model.
I was reading
podcast.
It and I was just thinking of my mom. I was like, my mom would like never, ever say she was a role model. And she was like CFO for Archdiocese of Washington. And so that's why I talk about her as much as I can, because she will talk about herself.
Exactly.
And I don't think like my reverse proud parenting is going to be what turns around the church's like public image when it comes to women leadership.
I don't know. I kind of think in a sense it does, because I think there are people who think like, what, who do you, you know, look up to, Ashley? Like, there's no one for you to even say. And you're like, no, actually, here's a bunch of people you may not be aware of. And I think that's important. I think it's important to raise up other people and not to force them to have to always do it themselves.
All right. We have time for our one and last final question.
Yes.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you ready?
Are you ready?
So, Carrie, if you could canonize anyone, living or dead, Catholic or non-Catholic, who would it be?
Woman or man?
All right. I am ready, because I was like, oh my gosh, they're going to ask me this question. Catherine McCauley. She is the founder of the Sisters of Mercy. She lived out...
Wait, I assume she was a saint already.
Right? You would think. She's not. So if you need a miracle, pray to her. We're all about it with the Mercy Associates and the Sisters of Mercy. No, she's not yet. She's on her way, but she's not yet a saint, and she definitely should be. And she loved tea. She loved the works of mercy. She was Irish. Like, there's all... She's this perfect person. I adore so much of what she is about and the way in which she lived out her leadership role as well. And so I think she should definitely be canonized.
When I think in your humility, you won't plug your book here, but I feel like... I would like to. You're all about mercy, right?
Yeah, so, you are.
Carrie has a great book called Mercy in the City.
Well, you're very kind.
Which Lent is coming up, and it was a Lenten project of all of the corporal works of mercy during Lent. So you guys should all buy the book and then do the works of mercy.
There's a blurb on it from Catherine McCauley. No.
It's a kickback scheme, really. Yeah. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks
so much,
Carrie. I'm
really
excited to be here.
Thanks, Carrie. You can find the study we talked about and all the articles, including Carrie's article, in our January 22nd print issue of the magazine. But you can also find it all online at americanmagazine.org/women. All right, now it's time for some listener feedback. So we put out a special request for this episode. We're giving away our latest issue, which features all of the articles about this great survey that America did, including Carrie's article and a bunch of other really amazing content. So we asked our listeners to nominate one woman for canonization. So we've picked a couple of the really great answers that we got. Zach, do you want to shout one out?
Yeah, Robert wrote that he would canonize Sister Mary, Mother of Merciful Love, SSVM. During college, she led campus ministries, Peace and Justice Committee. She led pro-life rosaries, mentored kids in at the juvenile detention center, and cooked meals for the homeless. So Sister Mary.
That's awesome. The next canonization comes from John Doherty, who is a fan of the show that we met at the Ignatian Family Teach-In for Justice. And we met his daughter, Rose, who she's doing very well now, but she had a brain tumor and had to go through chemotherapy. And so John would canonize his wife, Cecilia, who even during that like very difficult time of being in the ICU and not knowing how her daughter would be, he said it was a really difficult time and she didn't miss an opportunity to show love for the people around her. So that's pretty great.
That's really beautiful. Alyssa Roper writes in that she's from Australia and would like to nominate Sister Kathleen Williams, the Sister of Mercy, as the saintliest person she knows. She strongly supports others, especially women and lay people, who are doing the same by supervising them. And she says that she receives little attention for the enormous amount of work she puts into her students. So,
yeah. Sister Sounds like Kathleen. A lot like the women that Carrie talked about in her interview.
So, listeners, thank you for sending these in. Thank you for paying attention to the women in your life. Thank them if you haven't already. Like the people you thought of when we asked this question, let them know. Let them know that they're a role model. That's something that came out of our conversation with Carrie, I think. So.
Yeah. All right. Now it's time for Consolations and Desolations, the part of our show where we talk about where we found God this week and where it was harder to find God. What do you have, Zach?
So this week I have a consolation. I spent this past Monday, Martin Luther King Day, volunteering at a friend's company's service day. And I started out the day pretty cynical, just because there was something. I spent the day with kids from the Read NYC program in the United Way. So families were brought in, kids were brought in to sort of hang out for the day. And I thought there was something really, I don't know, just sort of uncomfortable about like a lot of white people talking to kids of color about Martin Luther King's legacy and the things that they need to like pay attention to about what he did. And so I was like, you know, none of these people like care about structures. They're just fulfilling some like service hour that their company's requiring. And I was super cynical. And I sort of masked it in like my concern for justice and structures. And so I was not super present. But then I got to hang out with one of the kids and just like spent the day coloring and making arts and crafts. And this little girl told me about how there was this like boy in her class that no one is friends with, and like she's going to resolve to be his friend is like part of the day. And it the consolation in this is that I was brought out of my own cynicism, my own like self wallowing by this little girl and brought into the presence of God. And it reminded me that I actually don't do enough charity. And a lot of times I like mask my concern for justice or structures. And I say like, you know, like I don't need to do this person to person contact and work in communion. And that's not the case. And so I was very consoled by that experience this Monday.
That's beautiful.
That's great.
Yeah.
What about you, Olga?
I've also got a consolation this week. So I've mentioned in past episodes that I've been really kind of struggling with being angry at God for various things that I've been going through my personal life. And I kind of just woke up this week and was just like, okay, you really have to be proactive about this. Like, you can't just wallow in this anger. Because just like any other relationship, if there's an obstacle, you have to work to kind of get through it, you know? So I'm like, it's okay. Like, every week I sit here and talk about faith with you guys. I talk about it with my boyfriend. And I'm like, okay, but how do you explore this on your own? So I reached out to Jim Martin, who has been on our show several times. And I was just like, Jim, I'm really interested in like meeting with a spiritual director. What do you recommend? And he put me in contact with a spiritual director. And I have my first meeting next week. And that was just really consoling because I don't know, I just took the moment to kind of just, I don't know, like pray and kind of have this conversation with God and be like, look, this is how I'm feeling right now, but I need to work through it, you know? And even though like a lot of those, that anxiety and that anger is still there, it felt like, okay, I'm being proactive about this. And it was really consoling to know that I'm working on sort of my relationship with God and taking this step forward. And it's been really consoling after all the weeks that I've had as well. So
that's great. Good on you. I do want to like say, I think that's amazing. I think that's a big step that a lot of people are afraid to take. And so if you're listening and you're like, I've always wanted a spiritual director, but I've been afraid or awkward or weird.
Right.
Like, whenever I talk to priests, that's their favorite thing that they do. So don't think that your priest is too busy for that, I would say.
Yeah. And I think also personally, I was like, it's okay to realize that you need guidance from someone other than mm-hmm. yourself to help you in this moment. Like, it's okay to feel like I'm feeling so negative and I can't do this on my own, you mm-hmm. know, and to kind of just reach out there and know that there are people there. So,
amen.
That's great.
So Ashley, what do you got?
I have a consolation too. This is,
wow.
This is good. So this is, full disclosure, I'm talking about something that happened 2 weekends ago, but it was so consoling and the consolation has stayed with me. So I'm going to bring it up again. Right. So I've had a feature article due for America on February 1st, but I've been working on it since like October, November. Mm-hmm. And by working on it, I mean not working on it and just having it hang over my head and just building up this like anxiety about it. And I've always had anxiety about writing. I just like put this like moral weight on it that makes actually getting words on the page like this feel like this huge task that I just like can't do and I get so nervous about. And then on that, I had sat down on a Saturday morning and I was just like, I need to get through this somehow. Like, I have to write something. The deadline is coming. And I was able to do that by really just like not making it about me. Like, writing, I think we can all agree, can sometimes be a very like self-centered endeavor where mm-hmm. you're just like, this is about me. This is about me coming off as smart or informed or, well, like very poetic or whatever. And I was finally like, this isn't about me. There are these people that I've interviewed and I really want to tell their story. And once I made it about participating in the act of creation instead of like just like being like, you know, the creator, because I really was like seeing myself as like the creator of whatever this article or the God in this situation, instead of just being someone participating and helping other people by telling their stories. And then once that weight was off my shoulder, I could actually just like write. And I wrote like 3,000 words and it was great. And so I'm like trying to like stay in that mindset because writing is technically a large part of my job. So I should probably not be so afraid of doing it. Mm-hmm. So that was consoling. Just like seeing my right place in this hierarchy of creation. So, yeah.
Amen. I admit my one takeaway is you saying that it was due in early February and you were freaking out about the deadline 2 weeks ago. I sort of lost. No, I'm kidding.
No, that's true.
All right, let's wrap.
All right. Judgewitical is brought to you by America Media and produced by Eloise Blondio. Our editor is Noah Levinson. Jesuit formation provided by Eric Sundrup, SJ. Engineering by Angelo Jesus Conta. Our logo is by Sean Tripoli. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show. Please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave us a review.
Yes, please.
Please, please, please. Please.
How many times do we have to say please?
Spread the love.
No, it really does help us, you know, move up in those rankings, those mysterious Apple rankings of podcasts. Yes. So that would be great. Shout out this week to Foggy Dell and GGTG.3. Another benefit, you get to make me say ridiculous words when
yeah,
you
whatever
leave
you name your, yeah.
when you leave a review.
But it is fine if we're number one in your hearts, but we really want to be number one in the charts.
And send us your questions, feedback, cocktail recipes, and tell us where you found God this week at judgewitical@americamedia.org. For America Media, I'm Ashley McKinless with Zach Davis and Olga Segura. We will see you next week.